Ladies and gentlemen, I consider it a great compliment on your part that you're here. If I were you, I wouldn't be. If I were you, I'd be taking a nap. If I fall asleep, well, someone in the front row wake me up. For a year, that guy with the radio. Now, be careful that you don't play a lullaby. It wouldn't take much for me to fall asleep. I've fallen asleep sitting while lecturing, but I've fallen asleep standing while lecturing. So we might be safe. I've told you a joke to start with, and I'll tell you another one in case you haven't heard it. It was one of the favorite stories of Paul Impey, whom you all know. Whenever he was addressing a distinguished audience, as I have the honor to address this afternoon, and anybody who comes this afternoon is distinguished, the other should be extinguished. But these a distinguished audience like that, he would tell the story. You know, Paul is a Pennsylvanian, a real Pennsylvania Dutchman. He would tell the story about this man who was a survivor of the Johnstown flood. Sometime before the First World War, there was a horrible flood in Johnstown, all kinds of dams that had been built by the mining companies broke down, and hundreds of people drowned, and this guy didn't drown. He survived. And from that day on, wherever he went, he would tell people of the Johnstown flood. He hadn't done anything in his life except survive the Johnstown flood. That was the most exciting thing he'd ever done, and he told about it, and bored the daylights out of people. They just couldn't stand him anymore. Whenever he was coming, they backed away, but because they knew he would tell them about his experiences at the Johnstown flood. And finally, he died. And he went to heaven, which has always been a comfort to me. It means that you can bore people for a lifetime and still go to heaven. Come to think of it, it should be a comfort to you. he went to heaven. And I have been given to understand when you get in there, there is sort of a show-and-tell time. I mean, everybody comes in and is allowed to say something that's interesting about him. And this chap who had been talking about the Johnstown flood forever, he was coming up to St. Peter and said, Sir, boss, I would like to tell him about the Johnstown flood. And Peter said, look, this is your moment. You can talk about the Johnstown flood. Remember one thing. Noah is in the audience. Most of human history, people have lived in a diagrammatic world. That means they have lived in a world in which there were very clear borders between them and the others. The Greeks, for example, lived in such a world. There were Greeks, Hellenes, and then there were the others. They called them the barbarians. Barbaroi is the word for people that can't speak Greek, and it was because they sounded barbar, barbar, barbar. That's why they called them barbaroi. They were people that weren't really people. Most people during human history have lived in a world where there was a very clearly defined group with whom they identified. Us. And then out there, the others, who were infidels, barbarians, foreign devils, whatever that word might be. This has been the case for human beings for most of human history. For example, Martin Luther, who has been mentioned a number of times in these days, Martin Luther never met in his entire life a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu, a black man. He lived, the only alien he ever met was a Jew. And he didn't get along too well with them, if you know this, the whole sad story. But this is the kind of world, a very homogeneous, a very diagrammatic world. If I had this blackboard, I would once do something that isn't three circles. I would make a line. That's my other picture. And on the one line, on one side of the line, that's us. And on the other side of the line, that's them. And these lines were very clearly understood. And if you weren't one of us, you were one of them. And the whole way in which the Reformation, for example, operates finally is, as you recall from church history, cuius regio, eius religio, whose the rule, his the religion. If you didn't agree with the plausibility structure that we have, then you better get out and go to other people. We can't stand anybody who doesn't agree with us on the basic plausibility structure, on the basic way in which we see the world. Now, one thing that is uniquely different about the world in which you and I have to live in 1975 is that we live in a dialogical world. Dialogical rather than diagrammatic. We live in a world in which all these differences are not on the other side of the border, but all these differences are right in our own communities. They are right, we are constantly confronted by people with different plausibility structures, with people who see the world substantially different from the way we see it. And this is what has been called a pluralistic world. A pluralistic world is a world in which people who see the world differently, who interpret the world differently, who have a different understanding, or to use a sociological term, a different plausibility structure, live right side by side. One of the shocking experiences for the kid that comes to the University of Iowa is if he comes from Pella or when he comes from some nice Norwegian town in Iowa and suddenly is at Iowa City and his roommate lives in a different world. He has a completely different value system, a completely different value structure. And pluralism is one of the most threatening realities because it calls into question not only what is right and what is wrong, but whether there is any right or any wrong. The whole thing is called into question. Now, there are two reactions to pluralism. The reaction of the East and the reaction of the West. The Eastern reaction to pluralism is associated with China and Japan. The Chinese, in order to escape this threat of pluralism, built a wall around their whole country to keep the others out. The Japanese, who had a word, Nihonjin, a Japanese, and Gaijin, the foreigner, the non-Japanese. The Japanese had a law which was enforced until 1868, the so-called Meiji Restoration. They had a law which said
Anybody who leaves Japan without the specific, the express permission of the emperor and who comes back will be executed. It reduced travel a great deal. And they were very serious about it because they felt that if Nihonjin were affected by these other people, these evil people, these demonic people, then they would infect all these good people. And they didn't want any contact with them. So the Chinese and the Japanese handled pluralism by keeping everybody out. The West handled the whole problem quite differently. When you mention Japan, you immediately think of Commodore Perry. What did Commodore Perry do? Well, in the textbook it says he opened Japan. He forced his way in other words. And the Western approach to the whole business was, we couldn't hack pluralism either. But we went all over the world and put pants on people and shirts and made them look like us anyway and taught them pidgin English, you know. We tried to make everybody like us because the idea that there would be people that really saw the world in a completely different way was more than we could hack. Pluralism is a development of the last 100 years. And only today, only in the last 25 years or so, has it come to the point where now practically everybody agrees that these differences are here to stay. That means even in these great political confrontations of our time, we're talking about coexistence. I think that ill-advised and disastrous war in Vietnam was the last feeble effort on the part of the West to force its particular way of seeing things on everybody else. And as you all know, it didn't work. Now, the problem that faces us as Christians is the problem, how do you relate to the outside in a pluralistic world? And now I'd like to turn again, if I can find it, to my Hartford affirmations and read to you 5, 6, and 7. In the face of pluralism, one false and debilitating response is 5. All religions are equally valid. The choice among them is not a matter of conviction about truth, but only of personal preference and lifestyle. And we comment, we affirm our common humanity. We affirm the importance of exploring and confronting all manifestations of the religious quest and of learning from the riches of other religions. But we repudiate this theme because it flattens diversities and ignores contradictions. In doing so, it is not only obscures the meaning of Christian faith, but also fails to respect the integrity of other faith. Truth matters. Therefore, differences among religions are deeply significant. It is my claim that we have done 2 very bad things in relationship to non-Christian religions. The first bad thing, and I don't know where you belong, what bad thing you do, you can confess to me later. But the first bad thing was the one where we said, we are going to do comparative religion and we are going to compare an idealized version of Christianity with the reality of other religions. That means, we said, look, Christianity is what it says in the New Testament, and Buddhism is what some Buddhist bonze does in China or in Japan. And then we said, look how good we look. Look at what it says in the New Testament, what a crummy person this guy is, you see? That was the first stage, and it was phony to the core and affected a lot of our relationships to other people with this phoniness. Unfortunately, this position has now been followed by equal phoniness. Now we compare the realistic version of what Christianity is with an idealized version of Buddhism or Hinduism or anything like that. And so instead of comparing the reality of what goes on in India or in Burma or in Japan, we compare what it says in the Bhagavad Gita with the reality of what goes on in Harlem, you know. And so again we get a completely phony and false comparison. It seems to me that one of the most important things is to face honestly differences. Some people can't handle it. A very common if you do it the fundamentalist way, then you say all these people are no good. They are all devil's children. They are idol worshippers. They are miserable people, which is most unfortunate because it is terribly unjust. On the other hand, the liberals say, well, They are all anonymous Christians. They all belong to the hidden church. And they are really the same as we are. No differences anymore. This is all the same. Now, I've always felt making other people into Christians who don't want to be Christians is a form of inquisition. Only the neat thing about the Inquisition was if you didn't like it, you could get burned, you know. But how do you get away from these missionaries who say, well, you're really one of us, you know. Don't bother you. My Jewish friends who are approached by these people and say, well, you're really hidden Christians. And I don't want to be a hidden Christian. I want to be an open Jew, you know. And I think he has every right to be this. Don't force people into phoniness, into something that's not genuine, that's not their thing. So the real question, the question that arises for all of us is how do we handle the obvious particularity of Christianity, the uniqueness of Christianity, in relationship to these very real values that we find in other religions, primarily, of course, in Judaism, because we are sort of descendants of Judaism, but also in Islam, we are cousins of the Muslims, but even with religions that are as different from ours as Buddhism and Hinduism and some of the other religions of mankind. Now, I think this is a particularly important question because we live, and I think this is undeniable, in a very religious age. Now, the 19th century, Puitsky's century, he's the last 19th century man. Where is he anyhow? Sleeping, I suppose. Now, I'll get back at you. Where are you, Walt? No, he isn't here. I'm going to take a nap next hour. The 19th century was really the century of the sort of fashionable unbelievers. The 19th century has gotten us stuck with all this death of God kind of business. This is strictly 19th century stuff. That's John Stuart Mill. This is Arthur U. Clough, George Eliot, Herbert Spencer, Matthew Arnold, T.H. Huxley, Nietzsche, Darwin, Freud. These are all really 19th century men. Let me read a little bit from them. From Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H. There is no heaven but this. There is no hell save earth, which serves the purpose doubly well, seeing it visits still with equalist apportionment of ill, both good and bad alike, and brings to one same dust the unjust and the just, with Christ who is not risen. This is Clough. Or, eat, drink, and die. For we are souls bereaved. Of all the creatures under heaven's wide scope, we are most hopeless, who had once most hope, and most beliefless, that had most believed. Now this is a 19th century man. Now let me read to you from a famous 20th century writer and poet. And you will see suddenly a real change. The problem is seen quite differently. The man is John Updike. And you know him because he wrote all kinds of dirty books. The Couples, Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux. Books, by the way, in which clergymen play somewhat peculiar part, if you ever, as a Lutheran in Rabbit Run, that we should really be embarrassed about. And I know people in the Ministry of Pennsylvania know who he was. John Updike wrote a poem called Seven Stanzas at Easter. And it is in his little book, Telephone Poles, if you have this book or have seen it. Now, this is tough. This is, it will shock you because you can hack it, most of you. You could take Clough, because you're all 19th century people, you can take Clough a lot better than you can take Updike. Make no mistake. If he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules reknit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouth and fuddled eyes of the 11 apostles. It was as his flesh, ours. The same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back. No papier-mâché, not a stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if he will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen, spun on a definite loom. let us not seek to make it less monstrous for our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest awakened in one unthinkable hour we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance. That's John Updike. That's a very modern poet. The 20th century is in a very unique sense an age of faith. But it is an age of faith in a pluralistic world, which means that we all exist like the Jews through the last 2,000 years as cognitive minorities. That means we don't have the support of sort of a general structure where everybody agrees and nobody agrees very much, but where we have to be tough, where we have to be tough in our lonely, idiosyncratic minority status, where we are a ghetto, but a ghetto not in the sense in which it is inappropriately used for people in modern sociology, but a ghetto in the sense in which the Jewish ghetto was a place where the people of faith gathered and maintained their faith against a world that was alien and denying their faith. We have to be this. We can only survive in a pluralistic world as a cognitive minority. Tough. Tough. But as a cognitive minority. Now, the problem is, how do cognitive minorities relate to each other? How can I, as a fairly adamant evangelical Lutheran Christian, and remember, I say nothing because I have to say it. I am paid by the Board of Regents of the state of Iowa. And if I turn atheist tomorrow, I keep my job. Don't get me wrong. What I say because I believe it. And how do we people who have to live in this as idiosyncratic cognitive minorities, how can we relate to the rest of the world, to other people who also are idiosyncratic cognitive minorities, who also are minorities, and there are literally now tens and hundreds in America. Now, to nobody's surprise who knows me, I would claim the way to relate is by rediscovering the distinction between law and gospel. As all of you know, God deals with human beings through his demand and through his gift. The demand is, thou shalt and thou shalt not. The demand is, be not deceived. God is not mocked. What a man sows, he shall also reap. The demand is, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. The demand is, if you want to put it in a sort of a nutshell, the golden rule. The gift is Christ. The gift is the forgiveness of sins. The gift is the resurrection from the dead. The gift is the baptism into his death and the Eucharist, the Holy Lord's Supper, as an anticipation of the eschatological feast. Now, the important point is that we as Lutherans can say honestly and openly, brothers and sisters,
who do not share our gospel. We share with you the law. In a pluralistic world, the law is the basis for our cooperation, not the gospel. If we can't make a distinction between law and gospel, we are forever going to make the law into the gospel and the gospel into the law. And I think this is going on all over the place, and it makes me sick. We can clearly, openly cooperate with Buddhists, atheists, Jews, everybody on the basis of the law. They know the law. Sometimes they know it better than we do. The law is not something that is limited to Christians. The law is, as the Apostle Paul says, those who are without the law have the law written in their hearts. The law is the experience that we all have in this world. That this, we didn't make it. It's not our world. It's a world that is that we find into which we are born and that has rules which... The law is the experience that we all have in this world. That this, we didn't make it. It's not our world. It's a world that is that we find into which we are born and that has rules which we ignore at our own peril. I can explain that to anybody. That's no big deal. Thou shalt not lie is not some idiotic law that somebody puts on because he wants to make things difficult for you. Thou shalt not lie is a simple rule of good sense that comes from the fact that if you lie all the time, we couldn't make sense to each other. That's something that every scientist knows when he starts fooling around with slides and paints something, results on the slides that weren't there. Remember? Just happened in New York and almost tore the Kettering Institution apart. Why? Because somebody lied. And you can't lie and be a physician who is a research man. You better be honest about your experiments. Otherwise, nobody can repeat them. Otherwise, the whole thing falls apart. This is simply part of the way things are. And my pagan neighbor, my pagan colleague is just as committed to this and more than some Christians I know. The law is the basis of our language, of our ability to say things so that they make sense to the other person. As some of you have heard me say, if I say chair and mean ceiling, and say ceiling mean grass, and say grass, and mean ocean, I might as well not talk. Language depends on honesty. Language depends on not lying. Those of you who, like me, have tried lying know that that's a very miserable business. I've been in situations where, in order to avoid embarrassment, I sometimes sort of didn't tell the truth because I thought it would embarrass people if I would come right out and say, but you're wrong, you know. And that turned out to be one of those things where I thought that was a little lie, and then I had to tell 14 big lies, and then I forgot what I had told before, and the whole thing sort of collapsed all around me. It just doesn't work. It's basically not functional. The law, as we Christians use it, is not some heteronomous bit that we put on people to make life miserable for them. But the law, as we Christians use it, is a good sense of the human race to help it survive in a world that makes survival often quite difficult. It's a lying, a terrible lying that did us in Vietnam. It's a terrible lying that did Richard the President Nixon in. Lying is bad. Not because Christians say so, because it is counter to the way the world is structured. And if you have a lying society, well, you see, Farrell, you don't know anything about comparative anthropology. Haven't you read Ruth Benedict's Patterns of Culture? I happen to have read it. And there are three cultures. There are the Dobos, the Kwakiutls, and the Zunis. And the Zunis are the only ones that work according to my rules. And you know what's funny? There aren't any Kwakiutls anymore. There aren't any Dobos anymore. But they're still Zunis. The rules like this are the rules of survival. And on that basis, we can cooperate with all human beings. You don't have to have a subscription to the Nicene Creed or the Augsburg Confession to get a policeman on the corner when a bunch of kids being run over. You don't have to agree with people on all kinds of fancy theological points when there are certain simple human problems to be solved. You just try and solve them on the basis of law and reason. But the gospel is something else. The gospel is this unbelievable miracle that God cares, that this is indeed not the tale told by the idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That in fact, this universe makes ultimately sense. Now, my friends in Iowa City and I totally disagree on that. We're still friends, but we totally disagree on that. On the law, I don't have any big problem. It's on the gospel that I have the big problem. And we must not reduce the gospel in any way to make it acceptable. Let me go back to my statement again. See, the great problem is, and now I'm going back to theme four, Jesus can only be understood in terms of contemporary models of humanity. This theme suggests a reversal of the imitation of Christ. That is, the image of Jesus is made to reflect cultural and countercultural notions of human excellence. We do not deny that all aspects of humanity are illuminated by Jesus. Indeed, it is necessary to the universality of the Christ that it be perceived in relation to the particularities of the believer's world. We do repudiate the captivity to such metaphors, which are necessarily inadequate, relative, transitory, and frequently idolatrous. Jesus, together with the scriptures and the whole of the Christian tradition, cannot be arbitrarily interpreted without reference to the history in which they are part. The danger is the attempt to exploit the tradition without taking the tradition seriously. Let me give you two examples. One is a book that only the older among you probably have ever read. It's a book called The Man Nobody Knows by a fellow by the name of Bruce Barton. There's a book, the flyleaf gives it away. On the flyleaf there's a scripture quotation. Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business. And business is in italic. And it's downhill from then on. The advertising man, his sales techniques, the recreation, all this, the remaking of Jesus in the image of the middle-class, affluent American businessman. That's a sellout, a complete sellout. But you have that sellout Jesus as Che Guevara. I know people that will say, if he is not a Che, he is not Jesus. You know, this is the same kind of sellout. You can sell out the particularity, the uniqueness of Jesus, who is a Christ, either by selling out to the conventional wisdom of the American middle class, or to the conventional wisdom of the revolutionaries. You can make him red, and you can make him reactionary, but what we have to insist on in our world as Christians is that we can't remake him at all, that he has to remake us, that we cannot have him conform to our ideals, but that there has to be conformitas Christi, that we must be conformed to him. And that's not so easy. But we can't have any less. My claim about particularity is that we mustn't get mixed up and try, because the law that is available to the rest of the world is the same law that is available to us, to remake Christ so that he becomes acceptable to the people that are committed to the conventional wisdom. Christ must keep on being different, unique, the Logos, the one who did something once and for all, F. Hapax. If we don't do that, we are betraying Christianity. But this does not mean that we cannot and should not and must not cooperate on the broadest possible basis with all kinds of people for the earthly betterment of human beings in this world. Always remembering that none of this ultimately saves anybody, but that it is penultimately of great importance. Frankly, since Witzke's not here, I hate to say that, but frankly, that what he sells you is far too narrow for me. All this business of helping the underdog must be done in a much broader context in order to be successful. We can't have it done by St. John's, by the gas station, by St. John's, by the supermarket, and all these people. This is to be much more broadly conceived in order to do anything, to really change anything, to make any difference. Otherwise, it's always going to be piddly stuff. We have to work with all kinds of people in order to bring about this earthly welfare of man. But you ought to keep in mind that if you have brought that about, then we've only put symptomatic relief on what is the real sickness unto death. Even if we all would have a full stomach and a PhD, these two great goals in life, if we all attained these fantastic goals, it would still not solve the ultimate problem. And it is only through the proclamation of the Christian gospel that the ultimate problem, which is namely that it is appointed unto man to die and after death the judgment, that this ultimate problem can be attacked. Now, I know there are all kinds of people, including my friend Karl Barton, who say this whole law gospel business is useless and can't be done anymore. I just would like you to look at it very carefully before you throw it away. And this is what I had to tell you this afternoon. Any comments or questions? Do we? I mean, if we accept the gospel, I just am afraid that so many people who say they accept the gospel only accept the law. You see, when you ask them, when I ask my students that come to the university and say, now what's Christianity? You know what they tell me? God lives good, loves good little boys and he hates bad little boys. That means what we have gotten across, and I'm not exempting myself in any way from that, because although I have done really nothing else in the last 30 years but try to proclaim the gospel, people have always heard the law. For some strange reason, we have not been very good. And in fact, in many instances, you just You see, that was my claim. That's why I'm against Fletcher, because it's another legalism. That's why I'm against I'm okay, you're okay, because it's another legalism. That's why I'm against Schuller, because it's another legalism. By and large, the conventional religious wisdom is law. Now, I don't say the law is useless. I think the law has a function, but it's not the gospel. And nobody has ever been saved by the law. Or as the Apology to the Augsburg Confession says, lex semper accusat. The law always accuses. But it's a good thing. I'm glad we have it. I'm in favor of it. I'm a law and order man. Just like Nixon and his former vice president. Anybody else? The trouble is, when you bring in philosophical terms, then you always bring in something that's pretty hard for most people to get a hold of. Look, the reason that the philosophers never have any big audience is because you're too technical, too complicated. And most people can't be bothered to think that hard. It gives them a headache. And so you have to keep in mind that we cannot assume since Christianity is a worldwide movement in which we want to have the rich and the poor, the smart and the stupid, everybody. We're not going to do it by way of playing games with the three laws of logic of Aristotle, you know. Furthermore, I'm not that hard on Aristotle anyhow, you know. As my mentor Martin Luther said, that stupid pagan who told us that the feather is light and lead is heavy. I mean, he doesn't seem to... Oh, I mean, he had a tendency to hyperbole. Fortunately, I never inherited any of that. and so he did exaggerate a little. But the fact is that we can base it on that. I think in some situations, when we are confronted by problems, the Lutheran tradition allows us to use all the reason God has given us. You remember that funny book that Luther wrote on keeping children in school, in which he finally says, you know, if a person has two children, two sons, and one is sort of bright and the other is sort of half bright, he says, now, you're going to be hurt now. I can't help that. It's Luther who said that. Send the half-bright to the seminary and make him a pastor, because there the Holy Spirit does most of it anyhow. And the real bright one, send him to law school and make him a lawyer, because they are all reasoners, everything he's got. And without reason, nothing will get done. So, I mean, this is really his tendency. And so if that makes you feel bad, I can't help it. But it may also make you feel good. Anybody else? Yes? I don't know what you mean about programs, but what are some of the sort of basic things that legislatures and people like that have to tax laws and things like that? And these are really not laws that ultimately depend on your... whether you believe in the resurrection or not, but they can be done on the basis of reason and justice and equity and all these things. And this is not something... Now, I happen to believe that I, as a Christian, have an obligation to get involved in this, and if somebody else says he has to get involved in it as a Jew, and if somebody else says his atheism makes him getting involved in it, that's fine with me. But mainly I'm interested that he gets involved with it. And the fact that he's an atheist, or the fact that he's a Jew, or the fact that he's a Buddhist, doesn't necessarily interfere with his doing a fairly decent job. But I don't know if any of you have worked with people like that. I work with them all the time. You know, in my job, I can't be very selective of having only true believers on my committees, you see. And so we have to sort of work it out, and I'm always quite surprised and pleased how many atheists can work very nicely on problems in the interest of students and in the interest of the university, in the interest of the community. I don't know how they got there, but I probably, if you want a theological answer, I would say common grace. Yes, sir. Well, my point is, when people say we shouldn't proclaim the law, they usually mean we shouldn't do it in that wooden way in which we used to do it. You know, 15 minutes law and 5 minutes gospel every Sunday, you know. And all these people that had these Bibles that you could practically have in red and black letters. Red was gospel and black was law. This is, of course, perfect nonsense, because everything in the Bible can be law and can be gospel. As you all know, that the cross, if you come to the cross full of vim and vigor and what a good Christian you are, the cross becomes the law and really slaughters you. If you come to the cross completely brought down by the world and feeling that you're no good and hopeless and there's no meaning to your life, then the cross becomes the gospel and really gets to you and lifts you up. So what I hope we get away from is sort of a notion that, well, the worst example of that would be that the Old Testament is law and the New Testament is gospel, which would really be a disaster. Now, often we have done it badly, we have done it stupidly, but that the proclamation of the law, or at least the indication of the law, I think the law should be really produced, proclaimed indicatively, in the sense that you show people how it really works. I mean, the worst thing about the law, in a sense, is that we don't have to do anything to make it work. It works all by itself. I mean, you and I didn't do old Nixon, and he did that all by himself. You know, it just happens like that. This is the way, when I was a kid, I said to my Nazi friends, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked." I mean, that's what I learned at home. And boy, was I ever right. No. This has given me a sort of confidence in that subject. That really, that's the way it works. That ultimately, the law is not established by us. What we should do is tell people about it so that they don't come in complete surprise to us. That they've been lying all the time. Nobody believes me. They say, "Oh, that's surprising." If you lie all the time, nobody believes you. You shouldn't be surprised. You should have expected that. And so it works in all these. And this is really, I wish it weren't so. You know, mostly I wish the law wouldn't work so automate, so sort of by itself. It really does work like that. And it's really very frightening. Because a lot of people that I love get hurt, and I might get hurt. Just because the law works like that. But that's not because we Christians make it work like that. And we would really be neglect. What we have to tell is people that are going to get smashed by the law all the time, tell them about the gospel. The reason that some people say the gospel ought to be proclaimed is that because of the law proclaims itself. But the gospel doesn't. And if we don't proclaim the gospel, who does? Then they all come up then with this kind of thing that modern literature does. Modern literature just tells you constantly you can't win. You know? All of this, every one of these great novels of our age are novels of the hopelessness of the human situation. That you can't win. You're doomed. And if people really, now I wouldn't say that to a guy who thinks he's on top of the world, but for most people, I don't think the proclamation of the law is the acute necessity, at least where I am. Where I live, you know what the highest reason for death among my customers, the 18 to 22 year old, is? Suicide. Used to be automobile accidents. It's now suicide. Now, with this as a group of customers, I really think what my job is to get the gospel to them before they jump out of something, you know. So in your case, they may all be healthy, wealthy, and wise, and no problems, but I have never met people like that, and especially when I got to know them. And therefore, I tend to think that our primary responsibility is to the gospel. But we ought to be honest about the law, not kid them and say, you know, that there is no really any law. Everything's coming up. There's no such thing as a bad boy. And everything is going to come up beautiful, because it doesn't. Anybody else? Well, it seems to me that is a matter of strategy. I think we would be indeed very poor stewards if we did not proclaim the gospel in certain situations. But nothing is really worse than proclaim it in a situation where it is inappropriate, where it can't be heard. I must admit that I react very negatively to the guy who buttonholes me while I come out of a restaurant somewhere and says, "Have you found Jesus?" My reaction is, "I didn't even know he's lost." And I find this kind of approach basically unhelpful. But it seems to me there are all kinds of situations in which I am with people where if I don't tell them the gospel, I am really neglectful. I am really unfaithful to the gospel. But I think the gospel is taught to people whose confidence you have. It's taught to people who believe you, who trust you. And it is taught on the basis of, look, this is something that means a great deal to me, and this is why it means a great deal, and that's why I'm telling it to you, and this is why I'm sharing it with you. I think this kind of crude, heteronomous way in which it is often presented to people turns people off, quite obviously. And so it's a little bit that God, the Holy Spirit, ought to give us wisdom to say it when it, as you know, if you say it at the right time, it makes all the difference in the world. If you say it at the wrong time, it doesn't. Now, the pastor, who every Sunday is supposed to do it, is, of course, in a somewhat more tricky position. But, of course, he also has people that are voluntarily, more or less, there to listen to him. But I meant when you go outside, like if I'm in all kinds of situations where I'm probably the only person who is in some way a confessing Christian in this particular group. And I have to be really quite subtle, unless I want to destroy everything. If I came to all these meetings, say, "Now, friends, now listen to me, Christ died for your sins," you know, I think they'd throw me out. And I think they had a good point. Well, I think the main job of the church is to proclaim the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Is that short enough? So with this, I can't really do any better. So my grandfather used to say, when he found out that I wanted to become a minister, he said, "Look, George, sometimes you'll get stuck in a sermon and you'll be terribly embarrassed. If everything else fails, always say, 'For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth him should not perish but have eternal life.' If you have said that, then it's a good sermon, even if you said nothing else." And so this is how I'm going to close now.